This is Mia Albrecht. I am 19. Actually, pause. Today is March 14th, 2019. I am interviewing Darden Smith.
This is Darden Smith, and I am 57 years old as of 2 days ago. And I am a singer-songwriter. I live in Austin, Texas.
So first question, tell me a little bit about your childhood.
Yeah, I grew up in a piece of land outside of Brenham, Texas, and it was a farm. But my father wasn't a farmer; he was a banker. He ran the savings and loan in town. I had 100 acres, and so I was very much a farm kid: cows, chickens, all that stuff. And I got a normal childhood. Lived first and second grade. I spent in Dallas, which was kind of strange. Then we moved back to the same piece of land. But the great thing was, what I remember about it was, I was very connected to nature. I was very connected to plant life, animal life, migration patterns, and I worked all the time. We had to work because we lived in the country, so I had chores every day. So I got my work ethic from my childhood. Definitely got my work ethic from childhood. But as well, I started playing guitar when I was 9. So I was in the third grade when I started playing guitar. And then I wrote my first song when I was 10. And so that kind of got me going on the creative thing. I think I was always different as a kid. I was always a seer, I think. In that I remember I heard voices as a kid, and I had premonitions as a kid they seemed very normal to me, but I definitely had things. And I think I was an artist. I didn't know what art was because I grew up in a non-music, non-art family. There was no art in the house. I mean, it was like, you know, they had prints and things, but there wasn't really an art. There was no artists that were actually seen as somewhat subversive. My parents, they were lovely people, but they just grew up in the Depression, and it was like, it was about life of survival, and, you know, they worked, and very straight ahead people, lovely, but there you go. But I remember that I was really emotional as a kid, and very much of a very affected by my surroundings. Empathetic. I didn't even know what empathy was, but I was empathetic. And I was an art. I didn't know what art was, but I think I was an artist even at a young age. In that, I remember, seeing light, and wondering what it was. Like, I was mystified by light. Oh. And there was one time in particular. It was the first time I think I experienced art. Was I was standing in the hayloft of our barn, and I looked down into this field. It was hay season. It was like October, and it was late afternoon. And the sun was going down, and the sun had just lit up this pocket of dust that was hanging in this field. I was probably 10 years old, and I was just like mesmerized by this thing mm-hmm. that was out there. I didn't know what it was. But I remember being very moved by this, like very affected by this light. I didn't know what it was. So that was great. I had lived this sort of idyllic farm, country, rural life, and play guitar. But I was also, you know, into sports and fishing and all these things that kids are into. And then my family moved to Houston, the suburbs of Houston, when I was in the eighth grade. And it was a shock, a total shock to the system. I went from, you know, the place where we lived in Brenham, we had 100 acres. But I was surrounded by 500 acres that we knew all the people. And I kind of had free rein mm-hmm. to wander. And so I spent a lot of time just in nature. I'd come home from school, I'd do my chores, and quite often I would just go walking. And I would do it with, you know, shotguns, and mm-hmm. we hunted all the time and had guns and stuff. And but I lived outside of town, so I spent a lot of time on my own. So just wandering around on my own, a lot of imaginary friends, mm-hmm. a lot of time in my head making up stories, which I think is why I'm a songwriter. Mm-hmm. it comes from that time in my life of being able to create stories in my head and also make rhymes in my head. I could make rhymes when I was a kid. So that I went from that access to this huge amount of land to wander around on to living in a condo across the street from a golf course.
Yeah.
And it was shocking. And I remember the first week we moved to this place, it was just massive culture shock. And I was already into songs and I was already into songwriters. I knew who songwriters were. And so I was very influenced by the Texas music thing that was happening. So it would be like Jerry Jeff Walker, Willie Nelson. The songwriters were Guy Clark and Gary P. Nunn and John Prine. And that whole sort of folk country thing that was happening. And this would be in 1975. And so I just retreated into my bedroom as an eighth grader, retreated into my bedroom and wrote songs. And so, you know, the songs I was writing, I'd written songs before. I started writing when I was 10, you know, fourth grade. But these songs were a little more personal. And just, it's what I did. I just wrote songs along with, you know, sports and eighth grade stuff and ninth grade, you know, went on into high school. I had an older brother and sister. But Houston was, moving to Houston at the time seemed like a huge tragedy in my life, but it turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me because it opened up me to musical experiences, opened me up to people from around the world who lived in this community because people moved, it was a Shell and Exxon community, so people moved every 2 years. So I was around people that moved. They're from all over the country and all over the world. So in Brenham, everyone was related to each other. You know, it's a little town, you know. And also, the music scene was really rocking in Houston at the time. Mm-hmm. And so I had access to radio, which was really cool. It was the golden age of FM radio. So I just heard all this great stuff. And it was like my musical education was at that time. I got in bands. I was in really bad country bands in high school. It was great. Learned to play bass and guitar. And I just wrote songs all the time. And songs were this secret thing that I could do that no one else could do. So it made me cool, which is why most people play music, is because they want to be cool. You know, so you want to find a way to be cool. But it was, to me, it was this super unique thing that I could do that no one else in school could do.
Yeah.
So I really, and it also, it's a great way to meet girls, you know, and it was a great way to just sort of stand out and put myself. So I had a lot of older friends because I was the kid in the band who could figure out songs.
Mm-hmm.
So I could always figure out all the songs. I just was a musician. I never learned to read music. It's all by ear. So high school years, I got in a lot of trouble. I was also a lot of drinking and alcohol and drug problems in high school, bad. And I think that it was a part of just, a part of it for me was that art thing, that thing of seeing light as a kid and songs, what songs do to you. I didn't meet a professional musician until I was 19. So it was all just mystery to me what this was. But what it was getting out of my head in music and art gets you out of your head into this sort of bigger experience of life. And I knew, since my senses knew what that was and where it was, but I didn't know how to find it in a healthy way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think alcohol and drugs for me was this way to experience that thing outside of my mind, but it was really unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the same. It's the same to me. It's the same thing. It's getting out of the conscious, out of the, you know. And so I had to push that all the way to the edge, to get in massive amounts of trouble and lose friends and, you know, almost. But it was that was my childhood. And so then I graduated from high school. Got in a massive amount of trouble in high school and taught me that all that stuff is fun, mm-hmm. and it will also ruin your life and kill you.
Yeah.
By the time I went to college, when I met your dad in college, I was already trying to get clean and trying to get straightened up. But also was committed to being a musician. And even though I didn't know what it meant, didn't know what it was, my father, as we were, when I was growing up, his way to talk about, because you always have that talk with your, you know, your father, or what are you going to do when you grow up, all that kind of thing. And my father's way of looking at it was, what would you do if you didn't have to work? What would you do if you didn't have to work? Now figure out how to get paid to do that, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
Especially coming from a dad who had a really straight job. I mean, yeah. But he was told that by a man. He grew up on a farm in South Texas, and he was told that by a man whose parents were slaves. Oh, okay. So it goes way back in that. There's this heritage of that, which is really amazing. So I knew that songs made me very happy, and it just felt great to play my music. And I loved writing music. I remember the first time I wrote a song that was bigger than me, that came from somewhere else. It was like this other thing that happened. Mm-hmm. I was 16. And I remember playing it for my girlfriend at the time. And she told me, she said, don't ever play that for anybody. It'll freak them out. Mm. And it'll scare them. And she was scared. She was scared, a scared person, mm-hmm. you know. In general, she was scared. And this was this, I think it was this, and I remember her telling me that, like, don't ever play that for anybody. And I was like, that's awesome. I'm like, yeah. I'm on to something. If it scared her,
yeah.
then that's like, if a song that I wrote could raise that kind of emotion in somebody, then I'm on to something.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is,
yeah.
but I want more of that.
Yeah.
And so that's when I knew that I was, like, there was something there, and I knew that songs, and I was aware of people who played music. I used to go to clubs all the time. Mm-hmm. I had my brother's driver's license. My older brother, he was 18. And drinking age was 18, so you could get in clubs. So I stole his driver's license out of his wallet. 2 weeks after he turned 18, I stole his driver's license. And so I could get into all the clubs in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw all my heroes play when I was in high school. So I learned about all that. So I went to college and just started playing music.
So you talked a little bit about how your family isn't super artistic. Were they supportive of you?
No, not at all.
No?
Okay. No, they were, music was a hobby. And my father actually told me, he goes, son, that's not a job, that's a hobby.
Hmm.
And we had this crisis moment. There, it's basically mythological. You come up against your parents, you know, at some point.
Yeah.
And you have to become, either you become your own person or you don't.
Yeah.
And my father's very, you know, fiercely independent man. And he was an inventor, actually, in the financial thing. He invented a new kind of mortgage.
Oh.
And he marketed that. And that's what he was, you know, his, from the time I was a junior in high school up until the time I was like maybe 28, he had a company that mortgaged. And it was built around savings and loans. And when the savings and loan industry tanked in Texas, it took mm-hmm. him out. And so he went bankrupt and all that. But the way that I got around this question of being a musician was, I had this, you know, argument with my dad, and he was trying to tell me that being a musician was not a viable way to live, which it really isn't a viable way to live unless you're extremely lucky and mm-hmm. I'd work really hard. I said, well, we do the same thing, Dad, just you do it with numbers and I do it with songs. We're inventors. I invent songs. You invent this. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. And he kind of shook his head and went, yeah, okay, I get it. Yeah, you're on. And he's like my biggest fan now.
Awesome, that's great.
But early on there was no support. Mm-hmm. And my parents knew so little about music, they didn't know you could read music.
Really?
So there was nothing. And it wasn't that they discouraged me from doing it, they discouraged me from taking it seriously.
Yeah.
And because they didn't, they just weren't of the, they didn't know any artists. Mm-hmm. Like, you knew artists growing up.
Yeah.
I knew, definitely. I didn't.
Yeah.
So, like, the way that you grew up thinking, actually being a photographer is a valid thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Or being a writer. Or I'm a chef. Or you know, if your family story is, that is in your family story,
mm-hmm.
it's not like, you know, art is not from Mars.
Yeah.
it's like, not out of the soil. It's in the community.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. So I had to really go against my family story.
Yeah, no, I can see that for sure.
Yeah.
So you talked a little bit how you got started in music. In 1985, you won the New Folk at the Kerrville Folk Festival. Mm-hmm. How did that kind of feel coming into that
early in your career? Well, I'd lost it. I'd lost it three years running.
Yeah.
So it was this validation that, you know, New Folk at Kerrville Folk Festival was this big deal at the time for new writers. Bigger, I think it was more of a big deal then than it is now because it was the only game in town mm-hmm. as far as like validation for young writers. Mm-hmm. And so I was, it just sort of let me, it gave me validation. It was the first time I'd ever won anything in that realm. And so it was this sort of like tap on the shoulder, going, mm-hmm. good way to go, you know, attaboy. Of course, I thought I'd won a Grammy, you know. It felt like this huge thing to me, but it was more than anything, it was just validation from some of my of a older generation of peers.
Mm-hmm. And you have a poem on your website called No Plan B.
Yeah.
And
it's in my book. No Plan B.
And I just wanted to ask, like, kind of how your mindset is from 22 versus kind of now. Because you were really on this.
Right. So No Plan B is comes from my father.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea, because really, well, my father had a job in a bank. You know, he had a self-employed mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very entrepreneurial in that way. And I come from a long line of self-employed people. My grandfather was a farmer and a rancher. And just before him, it was these self-employed people. And I was self-employed all through high school. I had my own company, Odd Jobs Company. So I've always worked for myself, mm-hmm. you know, for the most part. So the idea is that if you have a plan B, you have to commit to... You have to commit to things 100%. And the best way to enforce your commitment is to, you have to be serious about the things that you're doing in your life, especially if you're an artist. You have to be super serious about mm-hmm. it. You can't take yourself too seriously, but you have to be super serious. And the best way to be super serious is to remove all possibility of something saving you or some net, some safety net. When you don't have a safety net, then it's like either make it work or don't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like at some point you have to grow up and be an adult about it. And it's like you have to play the game. Whatever the game is, mm-hmm. you got to play it.
Yeah.
And the best way to play the game is just commit.
Mm-hmm.
And but removing all possibility of something saving you. And there's no greater motivation than hunger.
Yeah.
There's no, it's just like it is the best. And so that the No Plan B was when I was engaged to my first wife, so Eli's mom,
mm-hmm.
Engaged to her dad, who's a former Marine, school superintendent, once again, child of the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
Schooling and everything, your schooling and your career decisions, everything was about security
mm-hmm.
because they'd grown from a time of no security. So his thing was, how are you going to support my daughter? So first off, she was 5 years older than me.
Yeah.
So she'd been out of college. She had a job and everything. I was like, what do you mean? And, but also, it was the thing. And I was wildly offended by this question.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do you mean? How am I? First off, she's going to work.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we're of a different generation, you know, and she's going to have a job. And, but I was wildly offended by, who are you to question me? And but then I wrote him a letter back. And the letter back said, you know, because his thing was, you should have a plan B. What's your plan B? Should you consider trade school? You know, or something. And I was like, if I go to trade school, I'll I'll become a plumber.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to be a plumber. And I was raised to have no plan B.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only way you make it work. And so I wrote him this letter back and stated that very clearly. And it turned out all right. But how has that changed between now? It's only gotten stronger to me. Because, I mean, I have this saying that is above my desk. And the saying is, let me make sure I get it right, is that you volunteered, period. You can quit at any time. But if you say yes, then show up and get busy. Make the change happen. Now, you volunteered. We all volunteer. We are not, I'm a white, middle class guy.
Yeah.
There's no one's keeping me down.
Mm-hmm.
Every choice I have in my life, I agreed to it.
Mm-hmm.
I agreed to this interview. Yeah. I agreed to breakfast this morning.
Yeah.
I agreed to live in a home. My kids are grown. I agreed to move in. I have two stepdaughters. My mm-hmm. partner is in Austria. I agreed. I volunteered.
Yeah.
I can quit at any time. There's ramifications for every decision.
Mm-hmm.
But if I say yes, commit, show up 100% and do what you said you would do. And I just, the older I get, I see, especially as an artist, is that the only way that I'm going to continue to have time in my life to spend writing songs, which is like makes me happier than mm-hmm. like anything else in my life, is writing. So I just want to I don't want anyone to call me. I just want to have time to write songs, and I want to run away from the world.
Mm.
I can't do that forever. I can't do that all the time.
Yeah.
But that's the goal. So if I don't commit to this life, I'll never have time to do that.
Yeah.
So I have to commit. So the commitment to what I'm committed to is much larger than it was when I was 22, because I have children. I have bigger bills.
Mm-hmm.
I have, these things that I do that aren't around songs, but it's my life.
Mm-hmm.
So the change happened for me when I was young. From the time I was like 17 until I was about 32, my sort of inner mantra was art is my life. Okay, so everything is about art,
mm-hmm.
which is a really kind of selfish thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a self-focused, it's like, it's me. With her divorce, I had a young child, I had responsibilities. My career had gone up and peaked and had crashed.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to value kind of who I am and what I am and how is this and how does it work and how do I keep going, da 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 da. And I switched those words around, and also I was experiencing beauty in life that was not connected to music, but that was giving me this, a lot of it came through my son,
mm-hmm.
Eli, a lot of it was coming through friends, love, natural beauty as well. And so I remember I was driving down Fifth Street in Austin one day, and I realized, what if I turn those words around? As opposed to art is my life, if I switch around to life is my art, then it's all the same. Then it's all good. Then it's everything. Then I can put the same amount of attention into my son, my parenting, or the meal that I'm cooking,
mm-hmm.
or the friend that I'm talking to. I can if I put the same amount of attention and commitment into that act as I am to a song,
mm-hmm.
then there's no loss. And then I can rationalize change to change, mm-hmm. and the expansion of what I'm committed to. And still, when I come to music, it's delicious.
Yeah.
It's like, then it's just like delicious. It's like beautiful, because now I get to focus and concentrate and commit into what my craft is and what I connect to the bigger world. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No,
so it really, that has changed. But the idea of no plan B, it's like I've only committed even more to the no plan B. Like there's no, like this is my life,
mm-hmm.
and this is what I'm going to do. And believe me, it's expensive.
Yeah.
It's an expensive lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's being an artist and committing to that life. You know, my kids grew up without a lot of material possessions. that other people, that other friends of mine were able to give their kids. You know, we weren't able to go on vacations the way they did. We weren't able to go on, you know, they didn't have the big screen TVs and gear, gadgets, and just economic stuff, you know. My kids didn't get that.
Yeah.
Because I had committed to living as a songwriter. And that, you could say that maybe some people would look and see that was a sacrifice on their part. I personally think, like, pretty awesome, you know? It's like everybody ate.
Yeah.
There was always a roof over everybody's head. They ate. There was enough money. And so my, you know, and I raised them with, you know, I mean, their moms worked as well. But it was fine. Yeah. And compared to most people in the world, we were in the top 5% of the world. Yeah. So we're good.
Yep. So you do so many creative things. Like you have your book, you do songwriting with soldiers, your nonprofits, you do drawings and things like that. Exactly. And how do you kind of keep that process vibrant in your life?
I don't do email till afternoon.
Okay.
That's one for me. It's like so that's the main thing. I don't really, I mean, I might look at the emails, but I don't answer them.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's great. It's a gadget. You can turn it off. It's fantastic. It's amazing. Like a light switch. So unless it's a crisis, of course, but, the way that I stay vibrant is, combination of things. There's the micro level of vibrancy, and then there's what I call the pipeline of vibrancy. So there's the day-to-day, and then there's the pipeline. And so I committed years ago, like probably when I was 20, in my early 20s or mid-20s, to do something creative every day. So something is going to be in the creative realm, whether it's writing, playing. I didn't draw at that time, but I was writing or playing or cooking, or something is going to be where I'm accessing and I'm able to lose track of time. What do I lose track of time in? You know, where in my life do I lose track of time?
Mm-hmm.
Remember those things and do that more, because that's where my joy lies. It's where your joy lies. That's awesome. What are you doing when you lose track of time? That's it. Do that more. The more you do that, the better your life is. Yeah, so do that. So I committed to noticing where I lose track of time and then making sure I do those things. And it's more, that's when it began to expand, because that's when cooking came into my life. That's when I've always been an athletic, so running. At that time I ran. So doing those things. So I just make sure I do that. I play guitar every day. Yeah. I wake up and, like, now, and this has been going on for the last probably 15 years, I wake up and pick up a guitar. I have a commitment to pick up the guitar within 10 minutes. Wow. Other time I wake up, there's a guitar on my bed.
Okay.
And I put it right beside the bed. I wake up, I pick up the guitar. I make the tea, and then I sit down with the guitar. Even if it's for 1 minute, I know that brings me joy. So I want to start my day with joy. Because awesome. Anything can happen.
Yeah.
The day is stressful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an adult. Things come up.
Yeah.
I want to make damn sure that I'm joyful first. So do that. And then that's why I began to draw when I was 30.
Mm-hmm.
I used to draw when I was a kid and stopped because my drawings were very strange. And they were very strange then because I had dysgraphia, which is where you can't, like, put everything in the same. Like, if I drew a picture of a face, it was bad when I... It's not that way anymore, although I think it does affect me and how I draw. It's being able for your hand and eye to do the same thing that your brain does. So... It's not that, there's probably a connection to dyslexia, you know, but it's basically a inability or a challenge to, like, if I drew a face, I wouldn't necessarily have the eyes in the right spot. The eyes would be on the page, but they might be off the face. It would be, or they might be upside down, or it's just like, so my drawings were just bizarre, and I used to get a hard time about it, so I quit when I was 10. I started drawing again when I was 30. But once I started drawing, and I loved it so much, it's cheap. It's ridiculously cheap to draw. It's like you need pens and you need paper. So I'm a total paper junkie.
Yeah.
Like those are my notebooks. Those are my stacks of... I've got years of those notebooks.
That's awesome.
Those are my favorite notebooks. And I have these notebooks. And then I have pins. And so I travel with pins. And I travel with paint. And I travel... So I draw when I'm on the road. I draw every day. So I just believe that... So that's the micro.
Mm-hmm.
How do I stay charged? Mm-hmm. And then... The pipeline is, as a working artist, you have to think, what am I doing today? What am I doing next week? What am I doing 3 months? What does a year look mm-hmm. like? What's going to happen this year?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then what am I going to do? Where do I want to be 5 years from now? And where do I want to be 20 years from now? You have to have that. Or I do. I don't know. I've been at it. Most successful artists that I know, there's this, it may not be highly defined, but it's this concept that you mm-hmm. have out there. And the further it gets out there, the more the concept is just a dream, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I realize I have to self-generate. Some people's artist's life and some people's business life, the work comes at them
mm-hmm.
and the money comes at them.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been that way. I mean, I'm incredibly blessed. You know, I'm just like, it's crazy. But I pursue things. Mm-hmm. I have to pursue money. And I have to pursue, to a degree, I have to pursue money. And mm-hmm. then to a degree, I have to pursue work. So I like projects.
Mm-hmm.
I like coming up with projects. And so I just go, oh, I've never done that. Maybe I could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of, yeah, at a certain point, I kind of got over my fear of projects that I haven't done because I realized, well, you know, it may not be great, but I can pull it off, you know,
yeah.
do something. And if I can't do it, I know people who do it well, and I'll mm-hmm. collaborate. So I don't have to know how to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
But committed early on, or I realized this early. I hope this all makes sense. I'm rambling a bit, but it's all a part of it. Is that I realized early on, and this is when I was on Columbia Records. So I was on Columbia for 9 years.
Okay.
Record deal, big record deal. You know, wasted an incredible amount of money, and but had a lot of fun. But I realized that the best people in a craft, like whatever your craft or interest is. The best people, and this especially goes with artists, the best will work with you if you ask them. If you just, you have to have your own craft level up to a certain mm-hmm. place, and you have to be interested and you have to be humble. But at a certain point, if you want to do a project with somebody, ask the best. Mm-hmm. They may not work with you, but ask another one.
Yeah.
And eventually, they'll say yes. If you have, you have to have your act together. You know, mm-hmm. you have to be taking care of your thing. But it's really all artists. They just want to work, especially
yeah.
in music. Like musicians, they just want to work.
Mm-hmm.
They need a gig.
Yeah.
So go to the best. Start at the best,
mm-hmm.
then work your way down. So don't hire your friends. You could become friendly with the best.
Yeah.
But don't hire your friends.
Yeah.
Just because they're your friends, if they happen to be the best, then great.
Yeah.
But get the best, and that forces me. To be on my game.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I have to. So it's this combination of every day. What am I doing? What am I doing next week? What do I want to do in a month? What's my calendar look like?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do I have enough space to be dreaming? You know, be dreaming. Do I have enough money?
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's see. You got to balance all that stuff. Then looking way out there, but then coming up with projects that push me. You know, over my career, I've noticed I get bored really easy. Really quickly,
mm-hmm.
get bored. So I have to come up with wacky projects to keep myself interested. So that's why I've done a lot of dance theater work in the 80s. Yeah, in the late 80s. In 90s, I started collaborating with a dance company in town. So we did 3 full-length dance theater works. The first one was based on the writings of Buckminster Fuller. I mean, it was strange stuff, but it was great. It was music without words. First time I'd written without words. Taught myself to program on synthesizers. Taught myself to play piano. Did 3 of those, which was totally bizarre, like strange. Yeah. And no money, cost no money.
Yeah.
After that, I got commissioned to do a symphony. So I did a symphony with the Austin Symphony, the first Austin musician to ever be commissioned to compose a symphony for the Austin Symphony. And I don't read music. So talk about terrifying.
Yeah.
Massively terrifying. And I did it. Mm-hmm. I pulled it off through collaboration. I collaborated with the arranger, collaborated with the symphony, and it got me over my fear of, got me over a couple of things. It got me over my fear of failure mm-hmm. in the musical realm. And also showed me that I'm a musician, not a songwriter.
Okay.
Songwriter, you can be a songwriter in that, but mm-hmm. really the overarching umbrella is I'm a musician. And mm-hmm. the umbrella over that is I'm an artist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I did this thing called Marathon, which is a song cycle based on the Jesus in the wilderness myth.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, none of these projects make any money.
Yeah.
It's not about that. The book is another one.
Yeah.
My new book. It's not about making money.
Mm-hmm.
It's about pushing myself. So using these projects to push myself out beyond what I would normally do
mm-hmm.
and not being and being fearless about money.
Mm-hmm.
Money is a beautiful tool, but it's also, in an artist, it can be a fear source.
Mm-hmm.
So you gotta get past that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, but like coming up and like, wow, how wacky can it get? I mean, let's just like go way wacky. And like every 7 years, I get this itch, and I can tell when it's coming on. It's like this itch of like, I gotta do something really crazy. And what haven't I not done? And what will push me further? And who's around me that's really interesting? How can I work with them? Like I have so many projects that I'll never get to them all.
Yeah.
You know?
Was the book your last project that you've done?
Yeah, the book was, and they last, there's like a long gestation period, and then there's like 2 years, and they always push me into another form of work and another form of, like, from the result of the book was I have art shows. Like, now I'm like selling art. It's like I never showed anyone my art.
Yeah.
And now I've had 2 art shows and I'm selling art, and you know, it's like the you know, I talked to Facebook yesterday, asked me about art for the building here, and
really?
So it's like I never saw that coming.
Yeah.
But if I hadn't done the book, that wouldn't have happened.
It just opens up new.
It
doors.
Opens up new. Yeah. So I have to open up the doors. So as a working artist, that's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
You have to open up the doors. Sometimes doors magically open for you.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, you have to open the doors yourself.
So tell me a little bit about your nonprofit work. I don't know what that is.
Nonprofit work, Songwriting with Soldiers is the latest iteration of the nonprofit work I've done. It started with a project called the Be an Artist program, mm-hmm. which was I would go around to schools and do creativity programs with kids. And the concept behind that was artistic thinking comes from attention, intention, and doing what you love.
Mm-hmm.
So put all three of those things together and you can have a more creative life. I did that in schools, you know, starting in elementary schools and on up into... I did that for a long time, and then that led to working, doing work at a homeless shelter in Newark, New Jersey, where I'd go in and work with homeless teenagers,
mm-hmm.
doing the same creativity thing, but then collaborating on songs. So songs were a part of the Be an Artist program as well. I'd write a song with a class. I was writing a song with these homeless kids, very urban homeless kids, and so African-American, Hispanic, largely kids, drugs, alcohol, every possible dark side of the human experience
mm-hmm.
I witnessed and experienced there through them. So I learned about the power of difference, the power of sitting across from someone and collaborating with someone who's different than you.
Mm-hmm.
And that art is this incredible way to bridge that gap. And then songs especially. And then I learned about trauma transference, where when we would collaborate, I'd collaborate with these kids, we'd write a song using their words mm-hmm. about their experience. The trauma that they've experienced in their lives would actually lift off and come onto me. It's called secondary trauma. It mm-hmm. happens with, you know, it's just there within life. So I learned about that. I learned about that everyone has a story. Everyone is traumatized about something in their life. Okay? Everyone's had a dark thing,
mm-hmm.
you know. When you tell that story, we're all dying to tell that story.
Mm-hmm.
And when that story is told to someone who will listen, it is so cathartic. Okay, everyone wants this. Now, if you can use art to be the receptor of that story, wow, what a service. Amazing. Then I did some conflict resolution work with Israeli-Palestinians, gangs, some companies, getting people to come together and write a song together. Then I met a soldier. And this is the, I just, all those lessons, all the years of writing songs, other years, in the years of doing the Be an Artist program, learned to write songs with groups of people, the trauma transference, the homeless kids, the conflict resolution work, getting people to come together, the power of difference, the just the craft of writing songs and co-writing songs with people, collaboration, fearlessness about what I can do, like, yeah, whatever, yeah, we'll make it happen, that kind of thing. I just saw that when I met these soldiers, it was like the highest level of that. Of being able to use all those skill sets to bring together what would in the surface be the furthest away from my human my experience. Like, I know nothing about being a soldier. So we started this nonprofit called Songwriting with Soldiers around this work, and we believe that we believe in the power of fostering creativity. Through fostered creativity, to enhance creativity, it builds connections. So you create community. And then that builds individual strengths. So then you're able to see what your individual strength is, which enhances your creativity, which creates, and then it's a big circle that just keeps going. And it's been the most life-changing thing ever. It's like, it's just totally changed my life, and I see that it's endless. It's endless because the work we've done, and my partner in this is a woman named Mary Judd. We started it together. We've known each other since the eighth grade. We both moved to the same town in Houston the same year.
Really?
So we were the odd kids.
Yeah.
I know her. She's like my sister. And brilliant, brilliant, brilliant woman. And so we see that what we've developed and come up with is a model that can be used across all traumas, all types of trauma. And can be used as a model to bring people together, to have community and to create connections where on the surface you would think there's no connection. There's no commonality. There's far more common ground. I've written songs with people who are as far across the political, the religious, and the life experience spectrum that you can get. And, you know, I've sat in a room with people who've taken hundreds of lives. Hundreds. And some of them dug it. Okay?
Yeah.
It was their job. They're very good at what they do. Okay, so my job is to love them as a human being. And when you get past that thing, then there's lots of space for opening. And if you know, I love to write songs. So that's my entry. And I don't have to be them. I'm me. They don't have to be me. They can't be me. There's no way.
Yeah.
They can be me. But if we put ourselves together, then it's bigger. And I've got me. You got you.
Yeah.
Like, you don't want me flying the helicopter.
Yeah.
I don't want you writing the songs.
Mm-hmm.
So we put our experience together. And that's shown me. So it's really this massive thing. And I look at it like, all your life has led you to where you are. It's all like, just like things. So all these years of being the kid, seeing the art, you know, the light, these experiences, drugs and alcohol, writing, career, all this stuff, ups and downs, the commitment, the daily commitment to song and to creativity and art as a way to keep my life going. Has brought me to the place. We're going to run out of time.
I think we can do a second part because I have a couple more questions.
So it's brought me to the place where the energy was all focused inward to myself and my own creativity and my story. Taking that energy, and it's like a flashlight. You turn the flash, as opposed to the flashlight pointing inward, you turn the flashlight out. So you're taking the same energy, the same effort, the same thing, and you're focusing it towards someone else. You become, you're able to lift people up and save lives
with
art.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And if you do that, you get paid.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Here, I'm going to pause.